This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oh, for the halcyon days when news was slow. Trade and drugs and NAFTA, oh my. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, the 11th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So very much to talk about, so little time. Trade, the swamp, and the draining thereof. Some labor market news as well. So we are going to dig right in. Don Lee is with the Los Angeles Times. Catherine Rampell is at the Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
Catherine, let me start with you. And in the news of Tuesday or Wednesday, I think it was, I was traveling. I was a little bit out of the news. But AT&T and Novartis having paid President Trump's then personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, a very large amount of money, each of them, to act as, in essence, a political consultant. And I want to ask specifically about the memo that came out of Randall Stephenson, the CEO of AT&T today, in which he said, and this is a quote, AT&T hiring Michael Cohen as a political consultant was a big mistake. Now, with the stipulation that this kind of thing or a version of it happens a lot in Washington, do we think AT&T believes it was a mistake, or do they think it was a mistake because they got caught?
Probably both. In that AT&T was clearly hiring him because they thought he had some sort of access. You know, Michael Cohen, for those who are listening, does not have any experience with telecom, with antitrust issues, any of that. But they were hiring him because they wanted some kind of access, at least they say, to the thinking, you know, to the insights of what this administration would be like. But remember, AT&T was facing a review of its proposed merger with Time Warner. Clearly, they wanted Cohen to provide something. And if Cohen, in fact, provided anything, it was not worth very much, right? The DOJ ultimately decided to challenge this merger. So they didn't get their money's worth if they were expecting it. And it's highly embarrassing for them because, you know, this is now public that they were trying to buy this access.
Don, the memo from Randall Stephenson at AT&T goes on, to be clear, everything we did was done according to the law and entirely legitimate. End of that quote. It is kind of interesting what's legal and what's not, right?
It is. And I think there's a legal issue. And of course, there's an ethical issue. And I think people are asking, well, you know, Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliano, said that the president did not have any awareness of these consulting arrangements. But shouldn't, you know, Michael Cohen have disclosed what he was doing? And I think the ethics questions that have been raised will continue to persist in this kind of environment.
Yeah, and we should say here, just to get it on the record, that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the president's press secretary, said today, look, this is evidence that, you know, the president is draining the swamp, that that's literally what she said, because AT&T's merger is being challenged by the Justice Department. So just getting that one on the record. Don, I want to stay with you and talk trade for a second. We're going to talk about NAFTA a little bit later in the program, but we're getting down to the wire here with this big trade deal that the president has said either we're out of or we're going to renegotiate. There was an interesting piece by Pat Toomey, the senator from Pennsylvania, today in the Wall Street Journal, in which he said, and this is the headline, don't try to blackmail us on NAFTA, Mr. President. I will vote no on a bad new deal and employ all legislative means to block a unilateral withdrawal. Interesting that the Republican Senate, at least in some ways, is trying to talk some trade sense into the president.
Well, I think that letter reflects some of the apprehension among the GOP lawmakers. Robert Lighthizer, the president's chief trade negotiator, has indicated, among other things, that he wants to either eliminate or water down investors' arbitration rights. And this is something that the GOP wants to keep. And What the thinking is that the president, if the administration can get a deal, will present this new NAFTA, mm-hmm. and with a threat that he would withdraw. And so it would give basically an ultimatum: either you accept this new negotiated NAFTA or you take no NAFTA. And so this is a gun to the head, which the Republicans and others just do not want to operate under.
Yeah. Catherine, I want to end with you and the labor market and a report that came out this week called JOLTS, job openings, and you're going to tell me what the rest of it is. I forgot.
Labor turnover.
Labor turnover. Thank you very much.
It's my favorite report.
I know it is, which is why you wrote a whole thing on it. And the really interesting thing is there is now a job opening for every unemployed person. Let me rephrase that. There is one job opening for one unemployed person in this economy. That is to say the numbers match.
Yes, this is the first time on record that that has been the case. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that the job right. opening maps onto a particular worker, right? I mean, there might be different skills, different geographic distributions of workers. Workers may not want to take the jobs that are being that are actually available, particularly at the wages that are being offered, et cetera. But this is nonetheless a good thing, right? It does suggest that the job market is tightening. That in theory, wages should be going up, although wages we thought were going to go up several years ago.
Caveat, right. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, practice is not exactly according with the theory right now, but it does suggest that things are looking up for workers and that we could finally see a turnaround in wages.
Fingers crossed. Catherine Rempel at the Washington Post, Don Lee at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Enjoy your weekend. On Wall Street today, not a whole lot going on, but quite the handy week. Thank you very much. At the corner of Wall Street and Broad, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. President Trump gave a speech in the Rose Garden at the White House this afternoon. Prescription drug prices were the topic du jour. First off, President Trump has a different view of this issue than candidate Trump did. There was nothing in his remarks today about using the buying power the federal government has with all the drugs it buys from Medicare to directly negotiate lower drug prices for seniors. Candidate Trump had made that promise that he would do that. Instead, the White House wants to use increased competition and pricing transparency to drive down those high and still rising prescription costs. From the Health Desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein puts the administration's plan into a little bit of perspective.
There's nothing in Trump's plan that will change the prices consumers pay overnight. About a third of the 40-page blueprint is devoted to ideas under review. University of Chicago economist Rena Conti says several proposals, though, including a plan to cap prescription drug prices for people on Medicare, would matter.
Reducing the out-of-pocket costs that patients pay will save real people money and increase their affordability to prescription drugs.
A key problem around drugs is that pharmaceutical manufacturers continue raising prices. The pharmacy benefit manager Express Scripts reports over the last decade, the list prices climbed 232% on the 100 most commonly used brand name drugs. Juliet Kabansky is with the Kaiser Family Foundation.
I think until we deal with this issue, then we're not really dealing with the problem.
One idea the administration floated today would limit price increases to the rate of inflation on infused and injected drugs in Medicare. That includes some of the most expensive drugs used to treat conditions like cancer and rheumatoid arthritis. David Mitchell with the group Patients for Affordable Drugs says there are several ideas, like increasing the supply of generics and giving insurers more leverage in negotiating, that could help with prices.
Today, the Trump administration began a process to lower drug prices, but there's much more to be done.
The industry trade group Pharma said some of these proposed changes could lower prices, but warned others would limit patients' access to life-saving treatments. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
All right, so Don Lee was talking about NAFTA a little bit up top. Without putting too fine a point on it, the future of free trade in North America has about a week to get figured out. It's less than a week, actually. House Speaker Paul Ryan said the other day Congress needs the details of what NAFTA 2.0 is going to look like if the White House wants to get it through both chambers of the legislature by the end of the year. There is a whole long timeline for this stuff, a 90-day notification period the president has to give Congress before he signs a trade deal. The full text of the agreement has to be made public for a month after that, other random time for review and analysis. But here's the deal. It's less than a week. Now, late this afternoon, Reuters reported that this week's round of negotiations has ended without a deal, but with a promise to get together again soon before Thursday. So, Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at how they might get from here to there.
Nothing motivates quite like a deadline. Just ask any trade negotiator or reporter for that matter. But just as true, it's always the toughest issues that negotiators settle last.
We've seen them drilling down on a couple of important issues, and that's very good.
Laura Dawson, director of the Canada Institute at the Wilson Center.
But two or three important issues do not get you to the finish line by the 17th.
Negotiators have claimed progress on one of their thorniest issues, which deals with auto parts. But it's not resolved yet. And then there are still other big complicated issues like intellectual property protections, how disputes are resolved, how much dairy farmers can sell to Canada. Susan Aronson is a research professor at George Washington University.
They may well agree to a NAFTA in principle, but I don't see how they can possibly achieve to a full NAFTA.
Meaning negotiators may have the outlines of a deal, but have to fill in the details later, since they still have a month before they're required to release the full text of the agreement. Or, Aronson says, they could narrow the scope, tackle fewer issues.
A lean NAFTA as opposed to a comprehensive update of NAFTA.
Thing is, because these are closed-door negotiations, we don't know exactly how far apart the sides are. Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute is actually cautiously optimistic.
All this horse trading can happen, you know, over the course of one day because everybody's plans are aligned. As long as they achieve agreement on the major issues, then they can balance out the gives and the takes with these less important issues.
If negotiators don't come to an agreement in time, they'll face passing their new NAFTA through a new Congress, which could be less friendly to the deal. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
A lot of the trade stories we've been doing lately, all of them, now that I think about it, have been about two broad slices of the trade economy. Commodities, steel and aluminum, most commonly, and tariffs. And finished products being either imported or exported, everything from hogs to washing machines. Herewith, then, a post-consumer trade story. Last year, the United States exported to China more than $5.5 billion worth of shredded steel, corrugated cardboard, and beverage containers, other scrap as well. That number's been coming down as China has started trying to get better quality, less polluting scrap. But now Beijing has effectively shut down scrap imports from the United States altogether. Adina Renee Adler does government relations for the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Just so I have some baseline here, what kind of scrap are we talking about with the Chinese now?
Yeah, sure. We're talking mainly paper and plastic and a lot of that that comes out of the household recycling streams.
Well, let's talk about what happened then and what it means. So I guess last week, right, as Secretary Mnuchin and that whole trade delegation were in China, the Chinese recycling folks, in essence, closed the door.
Yeah. So what happened last week is that they suspended the only company that is allowed to do pre-shipment inspections on scrap materials that are ready for export to China. This is a prerequisite for scrap. And so when you suspend the only company that is allowed to do this, of course, it means that all trade halts, unfortunately.
So where's it going? Or is it just sitting on barges offshore somewhere? Or what are the recyclers doing with it?
There were containers that had already left the port but had not yet arrived to China, and those are the ones where we're not 100% sure what's going to happen to them. Some of them are idling in the water. Some of them were diverted to other markets. There were some that were recalled back to the United States. I mean, it's a real big challenge right now. Yeah. It can create an opportunity. Do you think about finding customers? Do you think about new technologies? But it's going to take some time.
Give me a sense of scale. So this has been shut down for a month, right? It's May 4th to June 4th. How many tons of scrap and recyclables are we talking about here?
You know, it's funny. I haven't been thinking about tons. I've been thinking about dollars.
Oh, okay. Sometimes I can do that too.
Only because that's what resonates with policymakers.
Yeah.
We believe that about $400 million worth of trade is being impacted just within a month.
Wow.
And then on top of that, there could be even as much as another $100 million worth of costs associated.
With the stipulation that correlation is not causality, it is of interest and note that this decision was made or put into effect at the very same time that Secretary Mnuchin and Larry Kudlow and the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer were over in China talking trade.
The timing is awfully suspicious, especially because we're seeing in the press just within the last few days as well, inspection delays for a number of agricultural products and automobiles. And so all of this taken together, the timing is awfully suspicious.
There's a circle of life thing here that happens, right? I mean, we take all these the scrap and recyclable, we send it over there. The Chinese turn that into cheaper, in part, cheaper goods and cheaper packaging that they then send back to us, right? And then we take the scrap and send it back, and it goes on in a circle.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I do want to clarify that we do have a lot of recycling that does happen in the United States. And certainly to the extent that there are economies of scale where you can do some of the recycling processes in China, because just as you said, then they turn those commodities back into new products that they sell back here in the United States. And certainly this measure has been felt by Chinese manufacturers who demand these scrap commodities from the United States because they are high quality and they're ready to be used, ready to go back into a manufacturing stream. And so we're hearing from a number of those industries that are extremely concerned about being able to get those supplies. And then how are they going to be able to fulfill the orders for the consumer goods that they make out of these supplies?
Adina Renee Adler, she does government relations and international affairs at the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, Incorporated. Adina, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up,
Iran was sending a tremendous amount of their product here to the United States.
Global trade and a little green nut. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial dialed up 0.3% today, 91 points, 24,831. NASDAQ just about flat, 7402. The S&P 500 gained 0.1%, 4 points, 2727. For the week, the Dow up 2.3%, the NASDAQ packed on 2.7%, S&P 500 2.4% to the good. So here is how worried the pharmaceutical industry is about President Trump's plan to bring down drug prices. They're not. Bristol Myers up more than 1%, Pfizer up more than 1%, Eli Lilly up 2%, Merck up nearly 3%, CVS, whose fortunes are tied in part to drug prices, up more than 3%. The list goes on. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.97%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, it's Kai. You hear me say it all the time. Watch the bond market if you want to understand the economy. Well, you should also watch our YouTube channel for quick video explainers, things you've always wondered about, stories beyond the headlines. Subscribe on YouTube or at Marketplace APM.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Whatever you might be watching on TV or on your screen of choice next week, you can be sure media company executives and ad buyers are going to be tuning into something called the Upfronts. That's the big to-do every year that the major TV networks have to show off their new lineups and, not coincidentally, to sell the ads that will help pay for them. The Hollywood Reporter says the broadcasters are hoping to net about $9 billion in ad commitments, which would be nice for them, but also a very tough sell because streaming. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains.
If this high-stakes competition for viewers' eyeballs and advertisers' dollars were a bingeable TV drama, the cliffhanger at the end of each episode would be something like, can Network X sell enough ads to broadcast another day? Analyst Jack Myers at Media Village.
The overarching narrative is declining traditional ratings on real-time scheduled viewing and the continuing increase in viewers watching on platforms like Hulu, Netflix.
Myers says those companies mostly pay for programming by charging a subscription. Viewers are getting used to less advertising and ad prices are down. Fox and NBC are moving to run fewer, shorter ads to cut down on clutter and try to bring advertisers back, says analyst Brad Adgate.
We're bombarded with ads. The more ads that you see, the less you're going to remember them.
The broadcasters pitch to advertisers, less is worth more, so
they're going to want advertisers to pay a premium for that.
Amanda Lotz studies media at the University of Michigan, and she says in this drama, don't lose sight of the characters who stand to gain the most, us. We don't have to pay for cable when so much is available on demand.
For a consumer, what's actually happening is great because for now, we have more choice than we did before.
And choice means viewers can watch what they want, when they want, to see how the cliffhangers turn out. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The decision President Trump announced this week, pulling the United States out of the Iran nuclear deal, is going to play out in a whole lot of ways. Geopolitics and international security, of course. Big picture industrial policy, think all those Boeing planes the Iranians had on order as a good example. Also, somewhat smaller product lines, specifically an item whose trade fortunes sum up our relationship with Iran pretty darn well. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
If you ate pistachio nuts in the 70s, chances are they came from Iran, and they were probably red. Back then, exporters didn't think Americans would buy nuts whose shells had dark marks, so they dyed them. And we ate them up, 20 million pounds a year. Then, in 1979, this happened. Here's ABC News.
Some 60 Americans, including our fellow citizen whom you just saw bound and blindfolded, are now beginning their sixth day of captivity.
The Iran hostage crisis, which dragged on for 444 days. The U.S. responded by sanctioning Iran, freezing its assets, and putting an embargo on its imports. That meant no oil, no Persian rugs, no pistachios. The crisis wasn't the opportunity the American pistachio industry would have chosen to make its big move into the market, but
we got very lucky politically in that there was an embargo on Iranian products to the United States.
Louise Ferguson is a pomologist at UC Davis. She studies fruits and nuts. Ferguson says the embargo began just as U.S. farmers were starting to use new irrigation techniques that made it possible to produce a pistachio crop big enough to enter the commercial market.
We had a tree that was suitable, we had available water, and then we had markets.
But growing pistachios takes time. 7 years to get nuts off the tree, long enough for Iran and the United States to iron out their differences. By the mid-80s, Richard Matoyan with American Pistachio Growers says,
Iran was sending a tremendous amount of their product here to the United States.
And undercutting American growers with their cheap prices.
There are some very strict rules against dumping product into another country.
Based on those rules, the industry successfully lobbied for a 300% tariff on Iranian pistachios and virtually shut down their flow into the U.S. Iran took its crop elsewhere, and American growers had another chance to expand. Fast forward a few decades and a handful of diplomatic dust-ups with Iran that jostled the pistachio trade, and here's where we are now. The global export market is worth more than $2 billion and growing. Together, the U.S. and Iran control 80% of it, and they've learned to coexist by zigging when the other one zags. We're in a zigzag moment now.
We'll be imposing tariffs on steel imports and tariffs on aluminum imports.
It's still not clear how hard President Trump will hit China with new tariffs, but the country has already retaliated by bumping up tariffs on American pistachios by 15%. China bought nearly half our crop in 2016 for more than $500 million. But it spent even more importing pistachios from, yes, Iran. I got in touch with Farhad Aga, a big pistachio grower in Kerman, Iran, to see what this all may mean for the politics of pistachios. Aga's family's been in the trade for decades.
Because of this new trade war between China and the United States, the balance has been shifted in favor of Iranian pistachio being exported to China.
Aga says the collapse of the nuclear deal and new sanctions on Iranian exports could mean gains for U.S. growers elsewhere at Iran's expense. But for the U.S., China is what really matters now. If that relationship goes south, American growers may be facing a problem they could barely imagine in 1979. More homegrown pistachios than the market will bear. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, for which I, for one, am grateful. Howard Schultz, the executive chairman of Starbucks, said the other day that bathrooms in its stores are going to be open to everybody from now on. No purchase required. All you got to do is go ask for the key. Yes, there is more than a little bit of public relations going on here, but still, handy. All right, we're going. Dow Industrials down up 0.3% today. That's 91 points. NASDAQ just about flat. S&P 500 gained 0.1%. That is 4 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.